The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today I'll be reading from the August 13th edition of the New Yorker magazine. As usual, I will begin with a poem, this one by A.E. Stallings, entitled Swallows. Every year the swallows come and put their homestead in repair and raise another brood and skim and boomerang through summer air and reap mosquitoes from the hum of holidays. A handsome pair, one on the nest, one on the wire, cheat, 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 the two conspire to murder half the insect race and feed them squirming to their chicks. They work and fret at such a pace, and natter in between. With clicks and churrs they lift the raftered place, seaside taverna with their tricks of cursive loops and Morse code call, both analog and digital. They seem to us so coupled, married, so flustered with their needful young, so busy housekeeping, so harried. It's hard to picture them among the origins of myth. A buried secret rape, a cut-out tongue, two sisters wronged where there's no right till transformation fledges flight. But Ovid swapped them in the tale, so that the sister who was forced becomes instead the nightingale, who sings as though her heart would burst. It's Ovid's stories that prevail, and so the swallow is divorced, twice from her voice, her tuneless chatter, and no one asks her what's the matter. These swallows, though, don't have the knack for sorrow, or we'd not have guessed. Though smartly dressed in tailored black, spend no time mourning, do not rest. One scissors forth, one zigzags back. They take turns settled on the nest, or waiting on a perch nearby, to zero in on wasp or fly. They have no time for tragic song. As dust distills, they dart and flicker. The days are long, but not as long as yesterday. The night comes quicker, and soon the season will be wrong. Knackered, cross, they bitch and bicker like you and me. They never learn, and every summer they return. And now, from the fiction section, a short story by Richard Ford, entitled Displaced. When your father dies, and you're only 16, many things change. School life changes. You are now the boy whose father is missing. People feel sorry for you, but they also devalue you, even resent you. For what? You're not sure. The air around you becomes different. Once the air contained you fully, but now an opening's been cut, which feels frightening, yet not so frightening. And there's your mother and her loss to fill, at least to step into, while you manage all your own sensations and others. Fear. Opportunity. And always there is the fact of your father, whom you loved, but whose life has become only about its end, much of the rest quickly fading. So, you are alone in a way that is so many-sided. There is not a word for it. Attempts to find the word leave you confused, though that confusion is not altogether unwanted or unlocked. Try to find the word. It is not necessary to talk much about my parents. My father was a country boy from near Galena, Kansas, large and handsome and good-natured. My mother was a skeptical, ambitious town girl from Kankakee. They'd met in the club car of a Rock Island passenger train between St. Louis and Kansas City, where my father was headed to take a job. It was 1943. Neither of them could have said they had anything they weren't willing to lose. That they were far from perfect for each other and would never have married if my mother hadn't gotten pregnant. And I don't blame them for that. But if he had merely lived longer, she could have divorced him. And I could have gone to military school Which was my wish? Things could have turned out other than they did. No matter how patented life's course seems, when you are leading it day to day, everything could always have been much different. As I said, my schoolmates had begun to subject me to a strange ambivalence, as if my father's death had transformed me into a, quote, special person, end quote, or that loss was an improvement granted to few but desired by all. Yet, at the same time, these same people, boys and girls alike, seemed to look on me as they would on a person from an alien race, whom they were working out a reason not to like. I, of course, did not understand this, but the effect was that I became submissive to all of it, believing in it when it was fortifying and believing in it when it left me feeling abandoned. During this strange time, my mother, in her incomplete grief, began to believe she needed to take a job. My father's position had provided only for his burial, money that was now used up. The job she found, which she did not keep for long, only until she met her first boyfriend, was as a night cashier at a local hotel, which meant that she left for work when I was getting home and came back after I was asleep, or should have been. It was an older neighborhood there where we lived in Jackson. We had not yet moved into the duplex that lack of money would later make necessary, and large, once stately homes inhabited by elderly widows of long residence who rarely ventured out offered nothing to a 16-year-old. Though across the street from us, one of those residences had been converted into a rooming house, in front of which was a wooden sign with a phone number. Dial 33377. Nothing more. My mother would almost immediately disapprove of this house, disapproved even of the sign. The Dial House, she called it, with a kind of disgust. The people who lived there were transients, she said. Transient was a designation that meant undesirable, weakness, something that would corrupt you. And corruption was the force in nature she most feared with my father gone. Once he'd protected her from that, even feeling about him as she did. But being alone now, in this small southern capital, where he'd brought us and where we knew no one, subjected us, she felt, to every sort of pitfall and danger that could ruin us and ruin our chances for restoring life. Much unexplained activity went on in the Dial House, sometimes noisily late into the night, which was not the manner of life that people were accustomed to on Grandview Avenue. All sorts of people came in and out. It was a three-story house in need of paint and had many windows. It had been owned once by a well-known judge who'd had children and grandchildren, one of whom, it was said, still occupied the top floor and suffered shell shock in the war. I would sometimes look up at what I fantasized was his window and believe that I saw him, obscured behind a thin curtain. I never saw him outside, though I would not have recognized him if he'd walked up to me and said my name. Secretaries lived in the Dial House, waitresses, married couples, young and old, commercial travelers passing through town, musicians who played the local tonks and whose loud cars would be parked in front but then disappear in the early hours. Two men lived together there, young men, who were window dressers downtown. They would sometimes come and go, holding hands. I understood that my mother and me and my existence bore a resemblance to the life in the Dial House more than to life in those shuttered, shrubberied mansions along the street. We were transients. We simply didn't use that word about ourselves. Though, had we been able to stand outside of our circumstances, we'd have known who we were and who we had become. An entire family was also living there. The father drove a cab, which he owned and parked in front. They were Irish, something I knew because my mother spoke to the wife on occasion, and I had learned about them. She felt that these people, the McDiarmids, were an exception to her severe views about the other Dial House residents. She respected them because they were Catholic, which she'd been raised up to be in Illinois, and because they were a family holding together. She saw them as brave. The McDiarmids had a son, and a daughter, and possibly because they had not been in town long, these two did not go to school. The boy, Neal, was a year older than I was, and the girl, Kitty, was younger and stayed indoors most of the time. Neal was outgoing and friendly and sometimes drove the cab when his father was sick, which was often. My mother, as I said, was very clear that I was not to have anything to do with anyone in the Dial House. The buxom, winking secretaries, the cheap musicians, and the two queer boys. I was to be wary of all of them as if they carried an illness. But Neil McDiarmid was tall, sandy-haired, blue-eyed, and polite, and spoke in his happy, musical way my mother liked hearing. He seemed to bring her out of her worries and woes. Some quality of being Irish, she believed, caused the world not to bother him too much. It made a widow such as she was accede to a brighter view. Sometimes Niall McDiarmid would come across the street and perch on our porch steps and tell me about how life was in Ireland. He had gone to Catholic school in a town called Strathfoyle. His family had been left there, he said, and had come here for better chances. He didn't think, however, that for his father to be driving a cab instead of working on the docks was much of an improvement. Plus, living where they were, in a rooming house, crammed into small, bad-smelling spaces, when they'd had a whole house paid for where they'd come from, it made no sense to him. I, of course, had nothing to tell Neil that was interesting, that was as interesting as the things he had already done in almost the same amount of life. I knew only the one other place where we had lived, near where my father was born, in Kansas. And I knew that my parents had never gotten along well, and that I wanted to go to military school, but now couldn't. And of course, I knew that my father had died, not long before McDiarmid's move to the Dial House. Neil asked me whether I'd had to see my father dead, which was how such things happened in Ireland. He'd had to see his grandfather in his coffin, ghastly looking and wearing a light gray suit. He would never forget it, he told me. He asked me if my mother was thinking of finding a boyfriend, which he said would not happen in Ireland. Widows stayed widows there or left town, which was unfair. He asked if I talked to the two fellows, the window dressers. They were nice, he said. Nothing was wrong with them. He asked if I thought his sister Kitty was pretty. I didn't. And said that the two of them were Irish twins born 9 months apart to the day. To all these questions, seated where we were on the brick porch steps, I gave, I know, unsatisfactory answers. I had seen my father in his coffin, but it hadn't shocked me. I wanted my mother to have a boyfriend, so that she would not pay such close attention to me. I much preferred to hear about life in Strathfoyle, which was mysterious and inviting, a place I felt I would go to when I went out to live my own life, even though Neil assured me that I would not likely be welcome there. There were too many unfriendly English running things. Though a Strathfoyle was in Ireland, I could not see what English people, who lived in another country, had to do with anything there. What I did understand, though, was that I didn't know much and possibly never would, while Neil McDiarmid knew a world of things that mattered to him and would play a part in his future, rather than what he knew being just an accident of who he was and where he was born. As my school year went on, Neil's father, whose name was Jerry, was more and more under the weather, which was how Neil put it. My mother, in the meantime, seemed to grow less agreeable about the McDiarmids. She said that Mrs. McDiarmid, Hazel, had hinted that Jerry had a drink problem, and on another occasion that he had a lung condition from smoking, and that being in the South where it was damp made it worse. Arizona would be better. My mother said that Jerry's situation was, quote, a burden of the genes, end quote, and I should stay away from him. Though Neil, to my surprise, she maintained a regard for, describing him to me as ambitious and attractive and smart, which I believed was true. And because my classmates treated me the way they did, having Neil willing to act toward me as his younger friend, not his equal, but nearly, seemed a good chance for me, an opportunity to model myself on someone with possibilities. Harry was what Neil called me, as in, "Ain't that just right, Harry? You're taking the piss now, Harry," or "Go on with you, Harry." I didn't always understand these expressions, but I liked hearing them. My name, in fact, wasn't Harry, but Henry Harding, after my father, who, my mother said, had been named by his uppity relatives for a famous painter. When I asked Niall why he called me Harry, he laughed and said, "'Cause calling you Henry Harding is a bit of a mashup, a word sandwich." Whereas Neil was the commonest name in Ireland, and carrying it around made people like him and everything work out smoother, which was what you wanted. At the time, my father's death hung over life inside our house, but it did not come up so much in my dealings with Neil McDiarmid. I knew that Niall's willingness to befriend me had begun as nothing more than a kindness. Yet I also thought that he liked my mother, who was more than twice his age, but looked younger, and that she liked him. More than once, I featured a reckless scene of my mother and me and Niall on a train bound for Chicago or New York or someplace far from Mississippi, where people would know nothing about us and would not see us as the mismatched parts we were. My father had died in August, but by October my mother had become accustomed to working at the hotel and, to an extent, had stopped considering the world, including the people in the Dial House, as the sworn enemies of everything dear to her. It may also have been that by then she'd met Larry Scott, who was a professor at the local college and was divorced. I did not know where she'd met him, and he did not take much interest in me. Neil had now begun to drive his father's taxis more, and often at night when his father stayed in. From our front window, I would see the cab, a four-door Mercury of a late 40s vintage, sitting at the curb in front of the Dial House, its yellow roof lit up and the motor running. The words "Irish cab" and a phone number were stenciled on the door. And Neil would be in the driver's seat reading some paperback book in the dim inside luminance. Occasionally, he'd flick a cigarette or its ash out of the side window. If a customer called, the phone rang in the house, and Nell's mother on his plump or his plump sister would come out and walk down and tell Neil that where he was supposed to go and away he'd drive. Neil had told me that his father had made the decision to accept blacks as customers, as long as they were picked up at a house and transported to another house. He would not pick them up from the street, he said. This was, of course, was not how things were done in Mississippi. Coloreds had their own cab companies, the way they had their own everything. Neil told me that his father expected trouble from the whites, but he was not afraid. Ireland sported its own troubles, he said. You go no place by running from them. There were too many blacks who needed to be taken someplace to ignore them. The day before Halloween, which was meant to be on a Saturday, Neil was sitting in the cab in front of his house when I came home from school. When he saw me, he waved as if he'd been waiting for me. He climbed out and came to the front of our house, and right away I noticed something different. He looked sharper. His hair was shorter and neater, so you saw more of his handsome, smiling face, which seemed scrubbed, since he did not shave yet. He was wearing what I came to know was an Argyle sweater and a snappy pair of brown corduroy trousers and polished shoes. There was also a fragrance about him, something like lemons, similar to the tonic you got at the barber, where I'd gone with my father, and there'd been a life I fit into. My mother cut my hair now and didn't do a respectable job. "I picked up a whore in the cab last night," Neil just started off talking as if we'd been having this conversation already. For some reason, he was looking straight at me, intense, in a way he'd never done, as if he was trying to make an impression. He seemed charged up, but also to be keeping something back. He said "whore" so as to sound like "her." I don't know how I even knew this word, but I did. I knew what hers supposedly did without knowing the particulars. She told me interesting things about the higher-ups in this town, Neil said. Hilarious things. Well, what are they? I said. Again, Neil seemed changed. He seemed to me to be 20 years old suddenly, and to want me to be 20. Only I wasn't. I was a boy whose mother cut his hair and who missed his father and woke up at night realizing he'd been crying without knowing it. Oh, I'll have to tell yous, Neil said. You'll be bleeding with laughter and be raging for new stories every time, which I might just have because I'll be seeing her again, if you know what I mean. I guess he meant that he would take this woman in his father's cab again, and she would tell him more humorous stories about the officials in town, whoever they were. I was speaking just before to your ma'am, Neil said, which surprised me. He had been speaking to my mother by himself. This meant something. I wasn't sure what it was. She says you like the movies. Is that a fact? Well, yes, I said, I do. And I did. On Saturdays, when my father was there, he would take me downtown to the Prestige, where we'd sit through a whole afternoon slate, taking in horse operas, he called them, short comics and cartoons, sometimes a jungle show, and newsreels from World War II and Korea. After which, we'd walk sore-eyed out into the sun, and I'd feel weak, and also as if I'd somehow done something wrong. I didn't know what. That whole part of my life ceased when my father died. I hadn't been to a movie since, and my mother didn't have time to go and wouldn't let me go alone. Look then, Neil said. I could see his pack of smokes under the Argyle in his shirt pocket. How about we steal the cab tonight and go out to the Holiday? Under 16 go in free. You're well under 16, if I'm not mistaken. You've been old gloomy pants long enough. Your ma'am thinks it'll do you good. I'll regale you further about the higher-ups and their perverted shenanigans. Well, I was 16 already by several months, but I looked young for it, which didn't make me happy. I knew Neil meant that I could lie and sneak in. It's a Bob Hope gasser, he said. We'll have ourselves a ball. Immediately, I wondered if he intended to take the Hurer with us, and what would happen. I'd never been to the 51 Holiday, which was on the outskirts, and was a drive-in. Once at night, my father had driven us past there when a show was playing. There's the old Passion Pit, he said. You'll be right in there someday. On the big screen, a chariot race was in progress, wild horses and men in gold armor waving swords and shouting, all in complete silence, of course. From the back seat where I was, these events seemed to be really happening, not in a movie, but as if a whole other exciting existence was out in the darkness, something I could see but not enter. I'll go, I said. I was surprised that my mother had said I could go and trusted Noel to take me to look after me. This was how growing up happened, I guess. One fine day you were not who you'd been. She would have known nothing about the Hurer, of course. We'll depart 7:30, Neil said. He put his hand on my shoulder and gave me a shove back, something he'd never done. Tidy yourself up a bit, he said. You're going on a hot date with old Nile tonight, and he had the big smile going. Is anyone coming with us? I said, and looked down our street. One of the old ladies from the residences, yet to be converted to a rooming house, was outside in her pink house coat, sweeping china berries off her sidewalk. She stopped and frowned at Neil and me, and then waved her broom at us, as if she was angry. I had no idea why. You nasty boys, shoo! Go away, she shouted at us. You don't belong here. Shoo on, shoo on. Neil sneered at her and gave back the double thumbs down. Listen to her shite, he said. We're rubbish, but we'll show her she's rubbish. I had never seen Niall sneer. It was strange to see his face turn to it so fast, as if he'd had it ready. I'd seen my mother sneer at my father more than once. Possibly an even newer pattern to life was opening, one in which people sneered and others considered me as trash. Put on your laughing boots, old Harry, Neil said and shoved into me again, then started off across the street toward the Dial House. He seemed suddenly to be in high spirits, as if what the old lady had said to us had made him happy. At 7:30, Neil was waiting in the cab. It was almost dark. The little yellow roof globe shone dim in the twilight. Lights were blazing in the dial house windows. Hillbilly music was playing on a radio, and I could see somebody, a woman, walk past a window without looking out. The air was warm and summery, though it was late October. "I'm pondering joining the U.S. Navy," Neil said as soon as I got in, as if he'd been waiting to tell me. He was smoking. "Why?" My father hadn't served due to his heart problem, and I didn't know why Neil should join up if he was Irish. I didn't feel like I knew the right question to ask. We were driving out through the old neighborhoods toward Northside, where the 51 holiday was. "The old man conjectures if I join, I'll be handed a trade, and then they'll make me a citizen good as you when I get out. There ain't no war going on to get me blown to Jesus." He, of course, went with the British forces, dead against his will. "I'm not on for that. I prefer the ocean cruise and the hula girls." Neil punched my knee and flashed his big smile again across the dark front seat, which smelled like mildew. "How's about Harry? You go for hula girls? I bet you do." "Well, yes," I said, "I do." "I guess so." Neil was in high spirits still and wanted me to be. My mother had said to me that afternoon, "Your friend's being kind to you because you lost your dad. I like him. Neil's personable. You and he can have a fine time. Just try." "I will," I said. It was true. No one else had been kind to me. At school, they treated me like a sick person they didn't like. I didn't say this to my mother. It would only have discouraged her. The 51 holiday was out on the highway, where there were just some colored shacks and the jukes crowded in on Friday night. A string of cars with their headlights shining extended back from the ticket booth. The screen was already showing advertisements for businesses in town, a car dealership, a funeral home, a camera store, the hotel where my mother was working at that minute. There was still a crease of orange daylight low in the sky to the west, rendering the big square screen dimmer than it would be when it was full dark. "We need to inch in as close to the front as we can," Neil said, navigating us up to the little shack where a girl was selling tickets through the window. "Two?" the girl said. "Just the one," Neil said. "The baby here's barely 14. I stared ahead without acknowledging, as though I couldn't hear well. The girl peered in at me. "He don't look that young." "Well, how do I look?" Neil said, smiling. "Half smart," the girl said. "Where are you from, Louisiana?" "There, see, there's your answer." Neil ignored the question, handing her out a dollar bill. "I'm Albert Einstein." "Fooled me, Albert," the girl said, pushing red paper tickets through the opening. "You look just like an idiot." "Well, you're very welcome," Neil said, "and I'll be round to your house tomorrow for my kiss." "I'll be waiting," the girl said, "with my pistol." "They all love me," Neil said, pulling us toward the big fence parking enclosure where other cars were getting situated, their headlights washing out the advertisements on the screen. I admired how Neil went about things in his smooth way, driving with his elbow out the window, using the steering wheel knob, his cigarette tilted out. I liked that he didn't mind driving the taxi to the movie, and that he'd arranged it with my mother and made an impression that might even have altered how she thought about me. I liked that I felt detached now from my difficulties, school, and my misery about my father, and not knowing how to overcome bad feelings. Neil took life in his stride and seemed purposeful, whether it was being forced to leave home when he didn't want to, or encountering tears in the middle of the night, or lying his way into the drive-in. He had a natural understanding of what stood right in front of him. It was a better way to approach the world than always having to be right and someone else wrong, which was how my mother saw life and wanted me to be the same. Neil drove us around to the far side of the lot where there were no cars to block the view. I assumed he'd been here before. This would be a place someone would come to be with a girl in the dark. The old passion pit. Neil maneuvered the cab up beside a metal post where a speaker was attached by an electrical cord. He lowered his window and brought the speaker right inside with us and hung it on the glass. He turned off the headlights. "Now we're grand," he said. "Get ready to laugh your arse off." It was a word he used. It was Irish, I assumed. And it was strange to be sitting side by side in the taxicab, the nose aimed at the giant screen, just as if we were driving down a highway. But it was also exciting. Life seemed to be offering things in rich supply. "When does it start?" I said. "Comics go first," Neil said. "Then the eternal Egypt Bob Hope comes on. A whole ocean of laughs," the advert says. "Paris is in for the setting. You'll need to go there someday and live it up." He bopped me on the shoulder one more time. "I don't suppose you'd want one of my smokes. I find them calming." "No," I said, though I did want one. My mother had told me never to start. She'd smoked since my father had died, and our house smelled of it. She even smoked in bed at night. I would only ever do it, I thought, if I was alone. I didn't see why Neil needed to calm down. "How about Mr. Sneaky Pete?" Neil said, with his grin still on. From under the seat, he produced a brown paper sack, out of which a short bottleneck protruded. He unscrewed the cap, took a swig, and expelled a gasp. "Ooh, whoa, 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 whoa," was the noise he emitted. And immediately the inside of the car smelled like my father's breath when he and my mother had had their cordials. Which he called them because he said drinking made my mother cordial, though it never lasted long. "Shall I tempt you?" Neil said. "Just to file down the edge?" He pushed the sack toward me, and even though my lips would be on the bottle where his had been, I took the sack and did what I'd witnessed him do. Took a drink, without even knowing what the bottle had in it or what would happen to me. The liquor was warm after being under the seat, and it instantly caused my throat to close and my breathing to stop almost completely. I wanted to shout from pain and also to gag and cough in one eruption, but I couldn't allow that in front of Neil. I'd be accounted a fool. So instead, I got still and did not breathe. I let what I'd drunk drain down, burning out of my chest and start burning in my stomach, which wasn't as bad. My eyes were full. My face felt on fire. I didn't know how I was going to make any of this stop. "In the grip, are we?" Neil said, smiling, registering that I was unable to speak and possibly could not move. "Take yourself a wee breather," he said. "You're likely not dying. Leaving some for the room is customary. You've preserved your amateur standing, that's assured." "What is it?" I croaked with the breath I'd been instructed to take. "The Queen's Reserve," Neil said. "Pap keeps it in the hack, then forgets I'm susceptible. More so, possibly." My belly and throat were scorched all the way down, and though I didn't feel tipsy, which was my father's word, I'd been shamed and knew Neil was thinking belittling things about me. "Give us another bumpity," Neil said, and took the sack and turned up a second big swig. He was constantly smiling, no matter what he thought. "You're on brig rations now," he said. "You need to learn proper etiquette." And he screwed the cap back and snugged the sack under the seat. I concluded from the smell that what I'd gulped down was gin, which was what my parents had drunk as their cordial. I'd never touch it again. I felt as though my neck was swollen and my throat half its normal size. My mother had made a pot roast for dinner, and I'd eaten a good amount of it before we left. But I felt vacant inside and somehow developed a needling headache which made me want to go home. The gin had an effect on Neil as well. He'd suddenly lost his good humor and shoved himself against his car door as if something he didn't like had happened. I'd loused up the business of the liquor by being an amateur, but didn't see what I could do to restore myself. The comic feature, when it commenced, was one I'd seen at the Prestige and didn't think it was funny. I tried to laugh, but Neil didn't laugh at all. The Stooges were doctors in white coats and worked in a hospital and kept getting in everybody's way and punching one another and falling down. "Would you look at him?" Neil said from against his door. "It's pathetic. Get away. The old man says they're all Jews. Why do we watch them?" When the Stooges were over, there was intermission, and everyone was invited on the screen to visit the refreshment stand. "What do you want?" Neil said, not being at all friendly. People from other cars were streaming toward the low concrete building in the middle of the big lot, where dim lights shone and the projector seemed to be. "I told your ma'am I'd cuddle you," Neil said, opening his door. "What does baby want?" "Nothing," I said. "Thank you." I felt a long way from anywhere. Neil wasn't smiling anymore and had become someone I might not have even recognized. "Says nothing, gets nothing," Neil said, down into the interior, as if he was sorry I was there. He closed the door and walked off into the shadows. I didn't know what to do then. I briefly revisited being at the Prestige with my father and the good time we'd had. But those thoughts always ended with my father having his heart attack in the house in the middle of the night and being carted out on a stretcher, already dead. That could easily make me cry, which I didn't want to do in front of Neil. I did think, though, that we were just two boys, even if Neil could drive and drink and smoke and knew about hooers and was aware of things. I wasn't. Being stony and silent and crabby about everything had, in fact, made him seem not older, but less grown up than I was, as if his actual self was now being disclosed. When Neil got back, he bought a paper sack of popcorn, which smelled good, but he didn't offer any to me. He looked over as though he expected me to say something. I didn't intend to say what I'd been thinking. It would have made him madder, though I decided that mad was not what he truly was. There probably wasn't a word for how Neil felt. We were alike in that way, when all was said and done. The feature had now begun on the screen. The light cone shone over the car roofs, halfway illuminating them. People were hurrying to their cars, laughing and talking. Beer cans were being opened and car doors slamming. A man said very loud, "What the hell are you two doing back there? Don't make me have to call the police." A woman started laughing. "It doesn't matter anymore. We're married." "Egits, one and all," Neil said, and wound his window up so that the speaker clanked the glass. "Roll yours," he said. "I don't want to hear him start belting away. The dad's bad enough every night." I did what he said. Cool night air was immediately blocked, and I knew that before long we'd be hot. My head ached. I feared being hot would make me sick following the gin. Paris Holiday was the title of the show. It was in bright, smudged color and began on an ocean liner, with people dressed up and walking around, talking to one another. Some were speaking in a language that wasn't English, which I guess was supposed to be funny. A man with a large nose, a fancy sport coat, and a felt hat showed up and just stood in the middle of the room, which was like a hotel lobby, talking to everybody while trying not to smile. This was all that went on and wasn't a bit amusing. I'd never seen Bob Hope, but I understood that this man with the big nose was him. His voice sounded like the voice on the radio that I'd heard with my parents. I hadn't thought he was funny then either. Neil, though, did think he was funny. He laughed loudly at things Bob Hope said and at things one of the characters who spoke in the other language said. "Man, oh man," Neil said about a pretty blonde woman who came on the scene wearing a gray fur coat. "I'd be forced to give her a good swiving." "I guess you wouldn't, of course." And he said this to me in the desolate dark of the car seat. He'd taken another drink from his paper bag, but hadn't offered me any. And I didn't want it anyway. "Well, I don't know," I said. "And are you not entirely sure?" This seemed to make him irate. I should have said that I would. Possibly I was a little tipsy and didn't know it. "I would," I said. "Yeah, Phoebe, course you would," Neil said. "That's Anita Christ Almighty Ekberg. She's Swedish. They F-word everybody." I looked at the blonde woman, bigger on the screen than anything imaginable. Anita Ekberg was a name I didn't know, and I didn't understand how to think about effing her. I'd only heard this word from boys in school who told jokes about it. If Anita Ekberg was sitting where I'm sitting and leaned over and said, "Hey, Harry, give us a wee poke," doubtless you wouldn't even know where to begin. "Yes, I would," I said. Ah, you wouldn't. It's as plain as the egg. Neil smiled toward me in a scornful way. More things were happening in the movie. Bob Hope's big, ugly face filled the screen, his eyes cutting this way and that, his nasty lip curling. Anita Ekberg could be seen walking down a long high hallway, her high heels in her hand, carrying her fur coat. She was good-looking. Anybody would see that. Effing her might not have been that hard, even if I didn't know what I was doing. And then for a while, we both just watched. Neil appeared to feel he'd berated me enough, calling me a feeb and saying I had no etiquette. He himself laughed at all kinds of things. Goings-on I couldn't get the sense of, though I laughed as I did. "He's speaking effing Frenchy," Niall said about one of the players, a small fellow with a face like a horse who was always looking mystified. "French is effin' lame," he said, "though it's a bleedin' riot once you pin it down." He had the sack out again. "Have a boost," and he reached it across. My head still ached, and I didn't want a boost. But I took the sack and held it to my lips and let just the tiniest trickle get in. A clammy paper shred stuck to my tongue, plus a piece of popcorn. "Be prudent," Neil said. He no longer seemed angry. "We want you to get home upright." The tiny sip I swallowed didn't burn or make my breathing stop. It was actually halfway sweet. I was relieved that Neil might be coming back to his better self. "I'm guessing you miss your old dad an awful lot," he said, his voice grown softer. He'd turned down the volume on the speaker. People were whooping and laughing in the next car and in other cars farther away. It had gotten much warmer in the car, the way I knew it would have. "Hell of a thing," he said, and nodded. We'd never spoken about my father as a living person. Being friends with Neil had seemed good because that hadn't been necessary. My father, alive or dead, was everywhere I turned. But not between Neil and me. Taking me to the movies and paying attention to me was a kind of secret sympathy. He could have taken the whore with him, gotten drunk, and done whatever he wanted. He didn't have to put up with me, who was always sad, a feeb. "I do sometimes," I said, on the subject of missing my dad. I could hear my voice under the movie sound. It was as if somebody else was using my words, saying my thoughts. Only, I didn't want to be talking about these things. My heart right then began to race at the possibility I might say something that would make me start blubbering. It had happened before. "You know what I'd welcome the chance to do," Neil said, and reached across the warm, empty space between us and put his hand against my cheek, which startled me. It was nothing like him hitting me on the shoulder. It was more like what my mother had done many times in those past months. "No," I said. Give you a wee kiss, Neil said. And he let his rough hand roam back through my crew cut the way my mother did. I smelled popcorn on his fingers and the gin and his lemony fragrance. And I looked right into Neil's thick, dark eyebrows. They were like a man's, wiry and dense. "It might set things straight a bit," he said, leaning closer. I don't know, I said, my heart hammering. It had not had time to slow down. "Just give us a try," Neil said. He put his hand on my knee, put his weight on it, and with his other hand turned my cheek and mouth toward him and brought his face up to mine. And he kissed me on the lips, just like I'd seen movie stars kiss on the screen, or the way my mother kissed my father when she loved him. I can't say I wasn't shocked. I didn't move my arms or my hands, didn't move my face away or toward Neil while he was kissing me. I didn't take a breath or let a breath out. My heart did suddenly slow down, and the rigidness from when Neil was mad at me began seeping out. I can't explain it, but I felt myself relax. Not as if someone was kissing me, but as if someone had taken me aside and said something kind, which only my mother had done up to them. Neil made a low noise in his throat, just at the moment he was kissing me, an sound, which seemed unnatural, but was something he wanted to do. I did not make a noise that I know of, and was grateful when he pulled away. He licked his lips as he sat back, and then stared straight into my eyes. He seemed to be asking me something, to say words or to do something, maybe to kiss him. For two boys to kiss, I thought, wasn't the worst thing. It wasn't so different from kissing my mother, and it wasn't really like movie stars kissing when they were supposed to be in love. I just hadn't enjoyed it. He had kissed me. I hadn't kissed him. "So how was that?" Neil said. His wiry eyebrows rose as if he expected to hear something he liked. And I would have said something to make him happy, except I had nothing to say. I had never been kissed by a boy or even kissed a girl. It had been a surprise. But I had no intention of doing it again. At the same time, it didn't really matter that we'd done it, or that he had. "Did you even hear what I said?" Neil had pulled back against the door. He'd taken his hand off my knee, though he was smiling. "I said something," he said. "I said, how was that?" "It was all right," I said. "It was all right," Neil said. "A bit of all right? Take it or leave it?" "Yes," I said. I didn't know what else to say except leave it, which he wouldn't have liked. Neil turned to the steering wheel, put his clenched fists on each side of the circle, and tapped them. On the screen, away in the night, Anita Ekberg was in her fur coat, looking beautiful on the deck of the ocean liner. "Jesus," Neil said, not to me, I didn't think, but to himself, as if I weren't there. "You're an effin' waste, aren't you? A effin' little waste." "I thought," I started to say. Who knows what I intended? I trusted the right words would come out, but they didn't. "You thought?" Neil looked over at me. I'd moved against my own door, as if I might be ready to jump out. His smile was now the sneer I'd seen before. "You thought what? You thought I liked you? You thought I thought you were cute? You thought I didn't know what?" He seemed not to be angry, just disappointed at what he'd hoped to accomplish by kissing me, not having worked out. I was sorry it hadn't, either. "I thought you were sorry about my father dying," I said. It was now very hot in the car, and the movie sound filled the space. "I am," Neil said. "Didn't I say that? Don't be telling your mam about this. Is that a deal? She wouldn't take to it. She'd have me sent off not being an entitled citizen." "I won't," I said. Getting Neil sent off was the last thing I'd wanted to do. He was the only friend I'd had. If I lost him, I might as well give up on life. If we ever went to the movies again, I thought I'd kiss him, since all in all, it didn't matter so much to me. On the way home, Neil drove again the way I had admired, one-handed, window down, elbow cocked out, the cool night flooding in, brightening his cigarette between his fingers. I had my own window down, the night spinning around me. My head had quit aching. We hadn't stayed for the whole movie. Neil had lost interest, though I liked the part where the characters went to Paris, a place I'd done a World Book report on and wanted to see, though Neil said that Paris streets on the screen were really in California. Neil didn't speak for a long time. He seemed to be thinking. I wondered if kissing me was possibly just a normal act of consideration, and if you were Irish, you knew that, and no one got confused. A kiss could mean different things. I felt better for having gone to the drive-in with him, no matter what had happened there. "Tell me something," Neil said. We were back onto the old town streets, to the world. We were a taxi, not two boys in a car coming home from the picture show. I felt anonymous and protected. "What?" I said. "What's the very worst thing you ever did do?" He took a drag off his pell-mell and blew smoke into the night air and out the side of his mouth. For a long moment, I didn't say anything, and I can't say I was trying to think of an answer. I was intending not to answer at all. I can unquestionably tell you mine, Neil said, or at least the top three. Possibly, of course, they're just the ones I'm willing to admit to, with the worst remaining in the cupboard. Maybe start with the best thing you ever did, which should be easy since you're such a pattern of perfection. Tell us, Mr. Perfect. Your secret's safe with me. And he smiled as if he was pleased with himself. I haven't done many good things, I said, and I couldn't think of one good thing I'd done, though I'd never tried. We'll forgive that, Neil said. You have it in common with others. What did you do that was good? I said. Failed to F my sister when she asked me to. My crowning moment so far, which didn't last long. I let me guard down eventually. You mustn't tell your man that either. Well, I won't, I said. It didn't truly seem like the worst thing a boy could do, though I didn't have a sister. So now you, Neil said. I have to hold something over you, so you don't rat me out. Come on. I lied to my mother, I said. We were on our street, coasting down the hill, past the old residence and the brick school named after the Civil War hero. I don't care a monkey's arse about that, Neil said. There has to be something worse. Brave up. This is what friends do, reveal their awfulest. I didn't want to reveal my awfulest, but I told them because I wanted Neil to be my friend more than I wanted anything. When my father died, I said, I wasn't as sad as I thought I'd be. I felt terrible, but it didn't seem like enough. Ah, come on, Neil said. Do you feel worse about yourself than you do about him dying off? Yes, I said, I do. Well, then it's te absolvo, Neil said, stepping in front of the dial house, where there were lights in most of the windows, and one had a jack-o'-lantern with a candle. Our house was dark. My mother was still at work. We sat for a moment then with the engine ticking, the fragrance of sycamores in the air. With the hand that was holding his cigarette, Neil made a gesture in the darkness between us. What's that? I said. It means all's forgiven. It's what the pansy priests say through the grate when you spill it. It's a way of saying, who gives a shite? You'll do worse. You'll kill and steal and break people's hearts and F your sister and burn down houses. I've often wished me pap was dead. Top that, I wasn't going to bleat it, but there we are. We've pled our troth. Whatever. Te absolvo. Having said that, Neil popped open his door. Come along, he said. It's time for innocent little Harrys to be in their beds. We've done our best and our worst, and we don't know the difference. Which was how that night ended, with the difference between good and bad blending into the darkness, as if this was all that life had so far taught us. Neil McDermid did not stay much longer in the dial house. For maybe a month, he was around our house. My mother continued to take an interest in him, despite her age. It seemed unusual, but that's the worst you would say about it. In any case, I saw him more and was happier and began for a while to get along better in school. One day, when I got home, my mother said, Now it's joined up. There's been some scrape with the cab taxi and the coloreds. A judge, she said, had given Neil a choice of fates, and Neil had taken the easy way and had gotten on the trailways to Louisiana that very afternoon. He'd said goodbye to my mother, but not to me, which I took hard, given that we were friends. In not too much time, Neil's family left out of the dial house. The cab disappeared. Their windows were dark. My mother didn't know where they'd gone, though. After a while, Neil wrote a letter and said they were in New York and would soon be back in Strathfoyle. He told us he thought the service would solve his problems, but realized he wasn't cut out for the military life. He had no stomach for fighting. He'd picked up a blue ticket, he said, and would likely be on a freighter to Ireland himself. When I read the letter, I wondered what kind of boy would I say Neil was. We go through life with notions that we know what a person is all about. He's this way, or at least, he's more this way than that. And we know how to treat him, and to what ends he'll go. With Neil, I couldn't completely know what kind of a boy he was. He was good, I believed, at heart. Or mainly, he was kind, or could be kind. He knew things, but I was also certain that I knew things he didn't and could see how he could be led wrong and be wrong that way all his life. Neil would come to no good end, my mother said a day after his letter came. Something had disappointed her. Something transient or displaced in him. Something had been attracted to her about Neil in her fragile state, and had been attractive to me in my own rare state. But you couldn't bank on what Neil was, which was the word my father used. That was what you looked for, he thought, in the people you wanted closest to you. People you could bank on. It sounds easy enough, but if only, and I have thought it 1,000 times since those days when my mother and I were alone together, if only life would turn out to be that simple. And we have a little time for some cartoons. The first cartoon shows a man standing in a living room, speaking into a microphone. Two elderly people, a man and a woman, are sitting on a couch having tea. The man with the microphone says, "But seriously, folks, the way you raised me, it's no wonder I can't get a gig in a real nightclub." Sounds like we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it today. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker broadcasts, are available as podcasts at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.